So this was Andrew Wiggin, the speaker for the dead. He didn't look ancient and wise at all, not the way Master Han did. Instead, this Wiggin looked foolishly surprised, the way all round eyes did, and his face changed with every momentary mood, as if it were out of control. Yet there was that look of peace about him. Perhaps he had some of the Buddha in him. Buddha, after all, had found his own way onto the path. Maybe this Andrew Wiggin had found a way onto the path, even though he wasn't Chinese at all. Wiggin was still asking the questions that he thought were Wang Mu's. The odds against the natural occurrence of such a virus are unbelievable. Long before a virus evolved that could link species together and control a whole biology, the proto-descoladas would have destroyed all life. There wasn't any time for evolution. The virus is just too destructive. It would have killed everything in its earliest form, and then died out itself when it ran out of organisms to pillage.
Maybe the pillaging came later, said Ella. Maybe it evolved in symbiosis with some other species that benefited from its ability to genetically transform all the individuals within it, all within a matter of days or weeks. It might only have extended to other species later.
Maybe, said Andrew.
A thought occurred to Wang Mu. The Descolada is like one of the gods, she said. It comes and changes everybody, whether they like it or not.
Except the gods have the decency to go away, said Wiggin. He responded so quickly that Wang Mu realized that Jane must now be transmitting everything that was done or said instantaneously across the billions of kilometers of space between them. From what Wang Mu had learned about answerable costs, this sort of thing would be possible only for the military. A business that tried a real-time answerable link-up would pay enough money to provide housing for every poor person on an entire planet.
And I'm getting this for free because of Jane. I'm seeing their faces, and they're seeing mine, even at the moment they speak.
Do they? Asked Ella. I thought the whole problem that Path was having is that the gods won't go away and leave them alone.
Wang Mu answered with bitterness. The gods are like the Descolada in every way. They destroy anything they don't like, and the people they do like, they transform into something that they never were. Qing Zhao was once a good and bright and funny girl, and now she's spiteful and angry and cruel, all because of the gods.
All because of genetic alteration by Congress, said Wiggin. A deliberate change introduced by people who were forcing you to fit their own plan.
Yes, said Ella. Just like the Descolada.
What do you mean? Asked Wiggin.
A deliberate change introduced here by people who were trying to force Lusitania to fit their own plan. What people? Asked Wang Mu. Who would do such a terrible thing?
It's been at the back of my mind for years, said Ella.
It bothered me that there were so few life forms on Lusitania. You remember, Andrew, that was part of the reason we discovered that the Descolada was involved in the pairing of species. We knew that there was a catastrophic change here that wiped out all those species and restructured the few survivors. The Descolada was more devastating to most life on Lusitania than a collision with an asteroid. But we always assumed, because we found the Descolada here, that it evolved here. I knew it made no sense, just what Qing Zhao said. But since it had obviously happened, then it didn't matter whether it made sense or not. But what if it didn't happen? What if the Descolada came from the gods? Not god gods, of course, but some sentient species that developed this virus artificially.
That would be monstrous, said Wiggin. To create a poison like that and send it out to other worlds, not knowing or caring what you kill?
Not a poison, said Ella. If it really does handle planetary systems regulation, couldn't the Descolada be a device for terraforming other worlds?
We've never tried terraforming anything,
We humans and the buggers before us only settled on worlds whose native life forms had brought them to a stasis that was similar to the stasis of Earth, an oxygen-rich atmosphere that sucked out carbon dioxide fast enough to keep the planet temperate as the star burns hotter. What if there's a species somewhere that decided that in order to develop planets suitable for colonization, they should send out the Descolada virus in advance, thousands of years in advance maybe, to intelligently transform planets into exactly the conditions they need. And then, when they arrive, ready to set up housekeeping, maybe they have a countervirus that switches off the Descolada so they can establish a real Gaiology. Or maybe they develop the virus so that it doesn't interfere with them or the animals they need, said Wigan. Maybe they destroyed all the non-essential life on every world. Either way, it explains everything. The problems I've been facing, that I can't make sense of the impossibly unnatural arrangements of molecules within the Descolada. They continue to exist only because the virus works constantly to maintain all those internal contradictions. But I could never conceive of how such a self-contradictory molecule evolved in the first place. All this is answered if I know that somehow it was designed and made. What Wang Mu said Qin Zhao complained about, that the Descolada couldn't evolve and Lusitania's Gaiology couldn't exist in nature. Well, it doesn't exist in nature. It's an artificial virus and an artificial Gaiology.
You mean this actually helps? Asked Wang Mu. Their faces showed that they had virtually forgotten that she was still part of the conversation in their excitement.
I don't know yet, said Ella. But it's a new way of looking at it. For one thing, if I can start with the assumption that everything in the virus has a purpose, instead of the normal jumble of switched on and switched off genes that occur in nature, well, that'll help. And just knowing it was designed gives me hope that I can undesign it, or redesign it.
Don't get ahead of yourself, said Wigan. This is still just a hypothesis.
It rings true, said Ella. It has the feel of truth. It explains so much.
I feel that way too, said Wigan. But we have to try it out with the people who are most affected by it.
Where's Planter? Asked Ella. We can talk to Planter.
And Human and Rooter, said Wigan. We have to try this idea with the Father Trees.
This is going to hit them like a hurricane, said Ella.
Then she seemed to realize the implications of her own words.
It is, really, not just a figure of speech. It's going to hurt to find out that their whole world is a terraforming project.
More important than their world, said Wigan. Themselves. The third life. The Descolada gave them everything they are and the most fundamental facts of their life. Remember, our best guess is that they evolved as mammal-like creatures who mated directly, male to female, the little mothers sucking life from the male sexual organs, a half a dozen at a time. That's who they were. Then the Descolada transformed them and sterilized the males until after they died and turned into trees.
Their very nature. It was a hard thing for human beings to deal with,
when we first realized how much of our behavior arose from evolutionary necessity, said Wigan. There are still numberless humans who refuse to believe it. Even if it turns out to be absolutely true, do you think that the Pecaninos will embrace this idea as easily as they swallowed wonders like space travel? It's one thing to see creatures from another world. It's another thing to find out that neither God nor evolution created you, that some scientist of another species did.
But if it's true, who knows if it's true? All we'll ever know is if the idea is useful.
And to the Pecaninos, it may be so devastating that they refuse to believe it forever.
Some will hate you for telling them, said Wang Mu, but some will be glad for it.
They looked at her again,
or at least Jane's computer simulation showed them looking at her.
You would know, wouldn't you? Said Wigan.
You and Han Feidzen just found out that your people had been artificially enhanced.
And shackled all at once, said Wang Mu. For me and Master Han, it was freedom,
for Qingzhou.
There'll be many like Qingzhou among the Pecaninos, said Ella. But Planter and Human and Rooter won't be among them, will they? They're very wise.
So is Qingzhou, said Wang Mu.
She spoke more hotly than she meant to, but the loyalty of a secret maid dies slowly.
We didn't mean to say she isn't, said Wigan, but she certainly isn't being wise about this, is she?
Not about this, said Wang Mu.
That's all we meant. No one likes to find out that the story he always believed about his own identity is false. The Pecaninos, many of them, believe that God made them something special, just as your God-spoken believe.
And we're not special, none of us, cried Wang Mu. We're all as ordinary as mud. There are no God-spoken. There are no gods. They care nothing about us.
If there aren't any gods, said Ella, mildly correcting her, then they can hardly do any caring one way or another.
Nothing made us, except for their own selfish purposes, cried Wang Mu. Whoever made the Descolada, the Pecaninos are just part of their plan, and the God-spoken part of Congress's plan.
As one whose birth was requested by the government, said Wigan, I sympathize with your point of view, but your reaction is too hasty. After all, my parents also wanted me. And from the moment of my birth, just like every other living creature, I had my own purpose in life. Just because the people of your world were wrong about their OCD behavior being messages from the gods doesn't mean that there are no gods. Just because your former understanding of the purpose of your life is contradicted doesn't mean that you have to decide there is no purpose.
Oh, I know there's a purpose, said Wang Mu. The Congress wanted slaves. That's why they created Qingzhou, to be a slave for them. And she wants to continue in her slavery.
That was Congress's purpose, said Wigan. But Qingzhou also had a mother and father who loved her. So did I. There are many different purposes in this world, many different causes of everything. Just because one cause you believed in turned out to be false doesn't mean that there aren't other causes that can still be trusted.
Oh, I suppose so, said Wang Mu. She was now ashamed of her outbursts.
Don't bow your head before me, said Wigan. Or are you doing that, Jane?
Jane must have answered him an answer that Wang Mu didn't hear.
I don't care what her customs are, said Wigan. The only reason for such bowing is to humiliate one person before another, and I won't have her bow that way to me. She's done nothing to be ashamed of. She's opened up a way of looking at the Descolada that might just lead to the salvation of a couple of species.
Wang Mu heard the tone of his voice. He believed this. He was honoring her, right from his own mouth.
Not me, she protested. Qingzhou. They were her questions.
Qingzhou, said Ella. She's got you totally boba about her, the way Congress has Qingzhou thinking about them.
You can't be scornful, because you don't know her, said Wang Mu. But she is brilliant and good, and I can never be like her.
Gods again, said Wigan. Always gods, said Ella.
What do you mean, said Wang Mu. Qingzhou doesn't say that she's a god, and neither do I.
Yes, you do, said Ella. Qingzhou is wise and good, you said.
Brilliant and good, Wigan corrected her. And I can never be like her, Ella went on. Let me tell you about gods, said Wigan. No matter how smart or strong you are, there's always somebody smarter or stronger. And when you run into somebody who's stronger and smarter than anybody, you think, this is a god. This is perfection. But I can promise you that there's somebody else, somewhere else, who'll make your god look like a maggot by comparison, and somebody smarter or stronger or better in some way. So let me tell you what I think about gods. I think a real god is not going to be so scared or angry that he tries to keep other people down. For Congress to genetically alter people to make them smarter and more creative, that could have been a godlike, generous gift. But they were scared, so they hobbled the people of Path. They wanted to stay in control. A real god doesn't care about control. A real god already has control of everything that needs controlling. Real gods would want to teach you how to be just like them.
Qingzhao wanted to teach me, said Wang Wu.
But only as long as you obeyed and did what she wanted, said Jane.
I'm not worthy, said Wang Wu. I'm too stupid to ever learn to be as wise as her.
And yet you knew I spoke the truth, said Jane, when all Qingzhao could see were lies.
Are you a god? Asked Wang Wu.
What the Godspoken and the Pecaninos are only just about to learn about themselves, I've known all along. I was made. Nonsense, said Wigan. Jane, you've always believed you sprang whole from the head of Zeus. I am not Minerva, thanks, said Jane. As far as we know, you just happened, said Wigan. Nobody planned you. How comforting, said Jane. So while you can all name your creators, or at least your parents or some paternalistic government agency, I'm the one genuine accident in the universe. You can't have it both ways, said Wigan. Either somebody had a purpose for you, or you were an accident. That's what an accident is, something that happened without anybody purposing it. So are you going to be resentful either way? The people of Path are going to resent Congress like crazy once they all find out what's been done to them. Are you going to be resentful because nobody did anything to you?
I can if I want, said Jane,
but it was a mockery of childish spite. I'll tell you what I think, said Wigan. I think you don't grow up until you stop worrying about other people's purposes or lack of them and find the purposes you believe in for yourself. Ender and Ella explained everything to Valentine first, probably just because she happened to come to the laboratory right then looking for Ender about something entirely unrelated. It all rang true to her, as it had to Ella and Ender, and, like them, Valentine knew they couldn't evaluate the hypothesis of the Descolada as regulator of Lusitania's gaiology until they had told the idea to the Pecaninos and heard their response. Ender proposed that they should try it out on Planter first, before they tried to explain anything to Human or Rooter. Ella and Valentine agreed with him. Neither Ella nor Ender, who had talked with Father Trees for years, felt comfortable enough with their language to say anything easily. More important, though, was the unspoken fact that they simply felt more kinship with the mammal-like brothers than they ever could with a tree. How could they guess from looking at a tree what it was thinking, or how it was responding to them? No, if they had to say something difficult to a Pecanino, it would be first to a brother, not to a Father Tree. Of course, once they called Planter into Ella's office, closed the door, and started to explain, Ender realized that talking to a brother was hardly an improvement. Even after 30 years of living and working with them, Ender still wasn't good at reading any but the crudest and most obvious of Pecanino body language. Planter listened in seeming unconcern as Ender explained what they had thought of during the conversation with Jane and Wang Mu. He wasn't impassive. Rather, he seemed to sit as restlessly in his chair as a small boy, constantly shifting, looking away from them, gazing off into space as if their words were unspeakably boring. Ender knew, of course, that eye contact didn't mean the same thing to the Pecaninos that it did to humans. They neither sought it nor avoided it. Where you looked while you were listening was almost completely unimportant to them. But usually the Pecaninos who worked closely with humans tried to act in ways that human beings would interpret as paying attention. Planter was good at it, but right now he wasn't even trying. Not till they had explained it all did Ender realize how much self-restraint Planter had shown, even to remain on the chair until they were done. The moment they told him they were finished, he bounded off the chair and began to run, no, to scamper around the room, touching everything. Not striking it, not lashing out with violence as a human being might have, hitting things, throwing things. Rather, he was stroking everything he found, feeling the textures. Ender stood, wanting to reach out to him to offer some comfort, for he knew enough of Pecanino behavior to recognize this as such aberrant behavior that it could only mean great distress. Planter ran until he was exhausted, And then he went on, lurching around the room drunkenly until at last he bumped into Ender and threw his arms around him, clinging to him. For a moment, Ender thought to embrace him back, but then he remembered that Planter wasn't human. An embrace didn't call for an answering embrace. Planter was clinging to him as he would cling to a tree, seeking the comfort of a trunk, a safe place to hold on to until the danger passed. There would be less, not more, comfort if Ender responded like a human and hugged him back. This was a time when Ender had to answer like a tree, so he held still and waited. Waited and held still, until at last the trembling stopped. When Planter pulled away from him, both their bodies were covered with sweat. "I guess there's a limit to how tree-like I can be," thought Ender. "Or do brother trees and father trees give off moisture to the brothers who cling to them?" "This is very surprising," whispered Planter. The words were so absurdly mild compared to the scene that had just played out before them that Ender couldn't help laughing aloud. "Yes," said Ender, "I imagine it is." "It's not funny to them," Ella said. "He knows that," said Valentine. "He mustn't laugh then," she said. "You can't laugh when Planter's in so much pain." And then she burst into tears. Valentine put a hand on her shoulder. "He laughs, you cry," she said. "Planter runs around and climbs trees. What strange animals we all are."
"Everything comes from the Descolada," said Planter. "The third life, the mother tree, the father trees, maybe even our minds. Maybe we were only tree rats when the Descolada came and made false ramen out of us."
"Real ramen," said Valentine.
"We don't know it's true," said Ella. "It's a hypothesis."
"It's very, 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 very true," said Planter. "Truer than truth."
"How do you know?"
"Everything fits. Planetary regulation. I know about this. I studied geology, and the whole time I thought, how can this teacher tell us these things when every pequeñino can look around and see that they're false? But if we know that the Descolada is changing us, making us act to regulate planetary systems..."
"What can the Descolada possibly make you do that could regulate the planet?" said Ella.
"You haven't known us long enough," said Planter. "We haven't told you everything because we were afraid you'd think we were silly. Now you'll know that we aren't silly. We're just acting out what a virus tells us to do. We're slaves, not fools."
It startled Ender to realize that Planter had just confessed that the Pequeninos still took some pains to try to impress human beings. "What behaviors of yours have anything to do with planetary regulation?"
"Trees," said Planter. "How many forests are there all over the world? Transpiring constantly. Turning carbon dioxide into oxygen. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. When there's more of it in the atmosphere, the world gets warmer. So what would we do to make the world get cooler?"
"Plant more forests," said Ella. "To use up more CO2 so that more heat could escape into space."
"Yes," said Planter. "But think about how we plant our trees."
"The trees grow from the bodies of the dead," thought Ender. "War," he said.
"There are quarrels between tribes, and sometimes they make small wars," said Planter. "Those would be nothing on a planetary scale. But the great wars that sweep across the whole world, millions and millions of brothers die in these wars, and all of them become trees. Within months, the forests of the world could double in size and number. That would make a difference, wouldn't it?"
"Yes," said Ella.
"A lot more efficiently than anything that would happen through natural evolution," said Ender.
"And then the wars stop," said Planter. "We always think there are great causes for these wars, that they're struggles between good and evil, and now, all the time, they are nothing but planetary regulation."
"No," said Valentine. "The need to fight, the rage, that might come from the Descolada, but it doesn't mean the causes you fought for are..."
"The cause we fight for is planetary regulation," said Planter. "Everything fits. How do you think we help with warming the planet?"
"I don't know," said Ella. "Even trees eventually die of old age."
"You don't know because you've come during a warm time, not a cold one. But when the winters get bad, we build houses. The brother trees give themselves to us to make houses. All of us. Not just the ones who live in cold places. We all build houses. And the forests are reduced by half, by three quarters.
We thought this was a great sacrifice the brother trees made for the sake of the tribe, but now I see that it's the Descolada, wanting more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to warm the planet.
It's still a great sacrifice, said Ender.
All our great epics, said Planter, all our heroes, just brothers acting out the will of the Descolada.
So what, said Valentine.
How can you say that? I learned that our lives are nothing, that we're only tools used by a virus to regulate the global ecosystem, and you call it nothing?
Yes, I call it nothing, said Valentine. We human beings are no different. It may not be a virus, but we still spend most of our time acting out our genetic destiny. Take the differences between males and females. Males naturally tend toward a broadcast strategy of reproduction. Since males make an almost infinite supply of sperm and it costs them nothing to deploy it, not nothing, said Ender.
Nothing, said Valentine, just to deploy it. Their most sensible reproductive strategy is to deposit it in every available female, and to make special efforts to deposit it in the healthiest females, the ones most likely to bring their offspring to adulthood. A male does best, reproductively, if he wanders and copulates as widely as possible.
I've done the wandering, said Ender. Somehow I missed out on the copulating.
I'm speaking of overall trends, said Valentine.
There are always strange individuals who don't follow the norms.
The female strategy is just the opposite, Planter. Instead of millions and millions of sperm, they only have one egg a month, and each child represents an enormous investment of effort, so females need stability. They need to be sure there will always be plenty of food. We also spend large amounts of time relatively helpless, unable to find or gather food. Far from being wanderers, we females need to establish and stay. If we can't get that, then our next best strategy is to mate with the strongest and healthiest possible males. But best of all is to get a strong, healthy male who'll stay and provide, instead of wandering and copulating at will.
So there are two pressures on males. The one is to spread their seed violently if necessary. The other is to be attractive to females by being stable providers, by suppressing and containing the need to wander and the tendency to use force. Likewise, there are two pressures on females. The one is to get the seed of the strongest, most virile males so their infants will have good genes, which would make the violent, forceful males attractive to them. The other is to get the protection of the most stable males, non-violent males, so their infants will be protected and provided for, and as many as possible will reach adulthood. Our whole history, all that I've ever found in all my wanderings as an itinerant historian before I finally unhooked myself from this reproductively unavailable brother of mine and had a family, it can all be interpreted as people blindly acting out those genetic strategies. We get pulled in those two directions. Our great civilizations are nothing more than social machines to create the ideal female setting, where a woman can count on stability. Our legal and moral codes that try to abolish violence and promote permanence of ownership and enforce contracts, those represent the primary female strategy, the taming of the male. And the tribes of wandering barbarians outside the reach of civilization, those follow the mainly male strategy, spread the seed. Within the tribe, the strongest, most dominant males take possession of the best females, either through formal polygamy or spur-of-the-moment copulations that the other males are powerless to resist. But those low-status males are kept in line because the leaders take them to war and let them rape and pillage their brains out when they win a victory. They act out sexual desirability by proving themselves in combat and then kill all the rival males and copulate with their widowed females when they win. Hideous, monstrous behavior, but also a viable acting out of the genetic strategy.
Ender found himself very uncomfortable hearing Valentine talk this way. He knew all this was true as far as it went, and he had heard it all before, but it still, in a small way, made him as uncomfortable as Planter was to learn similar things about his own people. Ender wanted to deny it all, to say, some of us males are naturally civilized. But in his own life, hadn't he performed the acts of dominance and war? Hadn't he wandered? In that context, his decision to stay on Lusitania was really a decision to abandon the male-dominant social model that had been ingrained in him as a young soldier in battle school and become a civilized man in a stable family. Yet even then, He had married a woman who turned out to have little interest in having more children, a woman with whom marriage had turned out to be anything but civilized in the end. If I follow the male model, then I'm a failure. No child anywhere who carries on my genes, no woman who accepts my rule. I'm definitely atypical, but since I haven't reproduced, my atypical genes will die with me, and thus the male and female social models are safe from such an in-between person as myself. Even as Ender made his own private evaluations of Valentine's interpretation of human history, Planter showed his own response by lying back in his chair, a gesture that spoke of scorn. I'm supposed to feel better because humans are also tools of some genetic molecule? No, said Ender. You're supposed to realize that just because a lot of behavior can be explained as responses to the needs of some genetic molecule, it doesn't mean that all Pecanino behavior is meaningless. Human history can be explained as the struggle between the needs of women and the needs of men, said Valentine. But my point is that there are still heroes and monsters, great events and noble deeds. When a brother tree gives his wood, said Planter, it's supposed to mean that he sacrifices for the tribe, not for a virus. If you can look beyond the tribe to the virus, then look beyond the virus to the world, said Ender. The Descolada is keeping this planet habitable, so the brother tree is sacrificing himself to save the whole world. Very clever, said Planter. But you forget, to save the planet, it doesn't matter which brother trees give themselves, as long as a certain number do it. True, said Valentine. It doesn't matter to the Descolada which brother trees give their lives, but it matters to the brother trees, doesn't it? And it matters to the brothers like you who huddle into those houses to keep warm. You appreciate the noble gesture of the brother trees who died for you, even if the Descolada doesn't know one tree from another. Planter didn't answer. Ender hoped that meant they were making some headway. And in wars, said Valentine, the Descolada doesn't care who wins or loses, as long as enough brothers die and enough trees grow from the corpses, right? But that doesn't change the fact that some brothers are noble and some are cowardly or cruel. Planter, said Ender, the Descolada may cause you all to feel, to come more quickly to a murderous rage, for instance, so that disputes erupt into warfare instead of being settled among the father trees. But that doesn't erase the fact that some forests are fighting in self-defense and others are simply bloodthirsty. You still have your heroes. I don't give a damn about heroes, said Ella. Heroes tend to be dead, like my brother Keying. Where is he now, when we need him? I wish he hadn't been a hero. She swallowed hard, holding down the memory of recent grief. Planter nodded, a gesture he had learned in order to communicate with humans. We live in Warmaker's world now, he said. What is he, except a father tree acting as the Descolada instructs? The world is getting too warm. We need more trees. So he's filled with fervor to expand the forests. Why? The Descolada makes him feel that way. That's why so many brothers and father trees listened to him, because he offered a plan to satisfy their hunger to spread out and grow more trees. Does the Descolada know that he was planning to put all these new trees on other planets? Said Valentine. That wouldn't do much to cool Lusitania. The Descolada puts hunger in them, said Planter. How can a virus know about starships? How can a virus know about mother trees and father trees, brothers and wives, infants and little mothers, said Ender. This is a very bright virus. Warmaker is the best example of my point, said Valentine. His name suggests that he was deeply involved and successful in the last great war. Once again, there's pressure to increase the number of trees. Yet Warmaker chose to turn this hunger to a new purpose, spreading new forests by reaching out to the stars instead of plunging into wars with other Pecaninos. We were going to do it no matter what Warmaker said or did, said Planter. Look at us. Warmaker's group was preparing to spread out and plant new forests on other worlds, but when they killed Father Keying, the rest of us were so filled with rage that we planned to go and punish them. Great slaughter, and again, trees would grow, still doing what the Descolada demanded. And now that humans have burned our forest, Warmaker's people are going to prevail after all. One way or another, we must spread out and propagate. We'll snatch up any excuse we can find. The Descolada will have its way with us. We're tools, pathetically trying to find some way to convince ourselves that our actions are our own idea.
He sounded so hopeless. Ender couldn't think of anything to say that Valentine or he hadn't already said to try to wean him away from his conclusion that Pecanino life was unfree and meaningless. So it was Ella who spoke next, and in a tone of calm speculation that seemed incongruous, as if she had forgotten the terrible anxiety that Planter was experiencing, which was probably the case, as all this discussion had led her back to her own specialty.
"It's hard to know which side the Descolada would be on if it were aware of all this," said Ella.
"Which side of what?" asked Valentine.
"Whether to induce global cooling by having more forests planted here, or to use that same instinct for propagation to have the Pecaninos take the Descolada out to other worlds. I mean, which would the virus makers have wanted most, to spread the virus or regulate the planet?"
"The virus probably wants both, and it's likely to get both," said Planter. "Warmaker's group will win control of the ships, no doubt, but either before or after there will be a war over it that leaves half the brothers dead. For all we know, the Descolada is causing both things to happen."
"For all we know," said Ender.
"For all we know," said Planter, "we may be the Descolada."
"So," thought Ender, "they are aware of that concern, despite our decision not to broach it with the Pecaninos yet."
"Have you been talking to Quara?" demanded Ella.
"I talk to her every day," said Planter. "But what does she have to do with this?"
"She had the same idea, that maybe Pecanino intelligence comes from the Descolada."
"Do you think, after all your talk about the Descolada being intelligent, that it hasn't occurred to us to wonder that?" said Planter. "And if it's true, what will you do then? Let all of your species die so we can keep our little second-rate brains?"
Ender protested at once. "We've never thought of your brains as..."
"Haven't you?" said Planter.
"Then why did you assume that we would only think of this possibility if some human told us?"
Ender had no good answer. He had to confess to himself that he had been thinking of the Pecaninos as if they were children in some ways, to be protected. Worries had to be kept as secrets from them. It hadn't occurred to him that they were perfectly capable of discovering all the worst horrors on their own.
"And if our intelligence does come from the Descolada, and you found a way to destroy it, what would we become then?"
Planter looked at them, triumphant in his bitter victory.
"Nothing but tree rats," he said.
"That's the second time you've used that term," said Ender. "What are tree rats?"
"That's what they were shouting," said Planter. "Some of the men who killed the mother tree."
"There's no such animal," said Valentine.
"I know," said Planter. "Grego explained it to me. Tree rat is a slang name for squirrels. He showed me a hollow of one on his computer in jail."
"You went to visit Grego?"
Ella was plainly horrified.
"I had to ask him why he tried to kill us all, and then why he tried to save us," said Planter.
"There," cried Valentine triumphantly. "You can't tell me that what Grego and Miro did that night, stopping the mob from burning Rooter and Human, you can't tell me that that was just the acting out of genetic forces."
"But I never said that human behavior was meaningless," said Planter. "It's you that tried to comfort me with that idea. We know that you humans have your heroes. We Pecaninos are the ones who are only tools of a biological virus."
"No," said Ender. "There are Pecanino heroes, too. Rooter and Human, for instance."
"Heroes?" said Planter. "They acted as they did in order to win what they achieved, their status as father trees. It was the hunger to reproduce. They might have looked like heroes to you humans who only die once, but the death they suffered was really birth. There was no sacrifice."
"Your whole forest was heroic then," said Ella. "You broke free from all the old channels and made a treaty with us that required you to change some of your most deeply rooted customs.
We wanted the knowledge and the machines and the power you humans had. What's heroic about a treaty in which all we have to do is stop killing you, and in return you give us a 1,000-year boost in our technological development?"
"You aren't going to listen to any positive conclusion, are you?" said Valentine. Planter went on ignoring her.
"The only heroes in that story were Pipo and Libo, the humans who acted so bravely, even though they knew they would die. They had won their freedom from their genetic heritage. What piggy has ever done that on purpose?" It stung Ender more than a little to hear Planter use the term piggy for himself and his people. In recent years, the term had stopped being quite as friendly and affectionate as it was when Ender first came. Often it was used now as a demeaning word, and the people who worked with them usually used the term pequeñino. What sort of self-hatred was Planter resorting to in response to what he'd learned today? "The brother trees give their lives," said Ella, helpfully. But Planter answered in scorn, "The brother trees are not alive the way father trees are. They can't talk. They only obey. We tell them what to do, and they have no choice. Tools, not heroes." "You can twist anything with the right story," said Valentine. "You can deny any sacrifice by claiming that it made the sufferer feel so good to do it that it really wasn't a sacrifice at all, but just another selfish act." Suddenly Planter jumped from his chair. Ender was prepared for a replay of his earlier behavior, but he didn't circle the room. Instead, he walked to Ella, where she sat in her chair, and placed both his hands on her knees. "I know a way to be a true hero," said Planter. "I know a way to act against the Descolada, to reject it, and fight it, and hate it, and help destroy it."
"So do I," said Ella.
"An experiment," said Planter. She nodded.
"To see if pequeñino intelligence is really centered in the Descolada and not in the brain."
"I'll do it," said Planter.
"I would never ask you to."
"I know you wouldn't ask," said Planter. "I demand it for myself." Ender was surprised to realize that in their own way, Ella and Planter were as close as Ender and Valentine, able to know each other's thoughts without explaining. Ender hadn't imagined that this would be possible between two people of different species, and yet why shouldn't it be, particularly when they worked together so closely in the same endeavor? It had taken Ender a few moments to grasp what Planter and Ella were deciding between them. Valentine, who had not been working with them for years, as Ender had, still didn't understand.
"What's happening?" she asked. "What are they talking about?"
It was Ella who answered.
"Planter is proposing we purge one pequeñino of all copies of the Descolada virus, put him in a clean space where he can't be contaminated, and then see if he still has a mind."
"That can't be good science," said Valentine. "There are too many other variables, aren't there? I thought the Descolada was involved in every part of pequeñino life."
"Lacking the Descolada would mean that Planter would immediately get sick and then eventually die. What having the Descolada did to Keen, lacking it will do to Planter."
"You can't mean to let him do it," said Valentine. "It won't prove anything. He might lose his mind because of illness. Fever makes people delirious." "What else can we do?" asked Planter. "Wait until Ella finds a way to tame the virus, and only then find out that without it, in its intelligent, virulent form, we are not pequeñinos at all, but merely piggies? That we were only given the power of speech by the virus within us, and that when it was controlled, we lost everything and became nothing more than brother trees? Do we find that out when you loose the virus killer?"
"But it's not a serious experiment with a control."
"It's a serious experiment, all right," said Ender. "The kind of experiment you perform when you don't give a damn about getting funding. You just need results, and you need them now. The kind of experiment you perform when you have no idea what the results will be, or even if you'll know how to interpret them. But there are a bunch of crazy pequeñinos planning to get in starships and spread a planet-killing disease all over the galaxy, so you've got to do something." "It's the kind of experiment you perform," said Planter, "when you need a hero." "When we need a hero?" asked Ender. "Or when you need to be a hero?"
"I wouldn't talk if I were you," said Valentine dryly.
"You've done a few stints as a hero yourself over the centuries."
"It may not be necessary anyway," said Ella. "Quara knows a lot more about the Descolada than she's telling. She may already know whether the intelligent adaptability of the Descolada can be separated from its life-sustaining functions. If we could make a virus like that, we could test the effect of the Descolada on pequeñino intelligence without threatening the life of the subject."
"The trouble is," said Valentine, "Quara isn't any more likely to believe our story that the Descolada is an artifact created by another species than Jing Zhao was able to believe that the voice of her gods was just a genetically caused obsessive-compulsive disorder." "I'll do it," said Planter. "I will begin immediately because we have no time. Put me in a sterile environment tomorrow."
and then kill all the Descolada in my body using the chemicals you've got hidden away, the ones you mean to use on humans when the Descolada adapts to the current suppressant you're using.
You realize that it may be wasted, said Ella.
Then it would truly be a sacrifice, said Planter. If you start to lose your mind in a way that clearly isn't related to your body's illness, said Ella, we'll stop the experiment because we'll have the answer.
Maybe, said Planter.
You might well recover at that point.
I don't care whether I recover, said Planter.
We'll also stop it, said Ender, if you start to lose your mind in a way that is related to your body's illness, because then we'll know that the experiment is useless and we wouldn't learn anything from it anyway.
Then if I'm a coward, all I have to do is pretend to be mentally failing and my life will be saved, said Planter.
No. I forbid you to stop the experiment, no matter what.
And if I keep my mental functions, you must let me continue to the end, to the death, because only if I keep my mind to the end will we know that our soul is not just an artifact of the Descolada. Promise me.
Is this science or a suicide pact? Asked Ender. Are you so despondent over discovering the probable role of the Descolada in Pecanino history that you simply want to die?
Planter rushed to Ender, climbed his body, and pressed his nose against Ender's.
"You liar!" he shouted.
"I just asked a question," whispered Ender.
"I want to be free," shouted Planter. "I want the Descolada out of my body, and I never want it to come back. I want to use this to help free all the piggies so that we can be Pecaninos in fact and not in name."
Gently, Ender pried him back. His nose ached from the violence of Planter's pressing.
"I want to make a sacrifice that proves that I'm free," said Planter. "Not just acting out my genes, not just trying for the third life."
Even the martyrs of Christianity and Islam were willing to accept rewards in heaven for their sacrifice, said Valentine.
"Then they were all selfish pigs," said Planter. "That's what you say about pigs, isn't it? In stark, in your common speech, selfish pigs. Well, it's the right name for us piggies, isn't it? Our heroes were all trying to become father trees. Our brother trees were failures from the start. The only thing we serve outside ourselves is the Descolada. For all we know, the Descolada might be ourselves. But I will be free. I will know what I am, without the Descolada or my genes or anything except me."
"What you'll be is dead," said Ender.
"But free first," said Planter. "And the first of my people to be free."
After Wang Mu and Jane had told Master Han all that had transpired that day, after he had conversed with Jane about his own day's work, after the house had fallen silent in the darkness of the night, Wang Mu lay awake on her mat in the corner of Master Han's room, listening to his soft but insistent snoring as she thought over all that had been said that day. There were so many ideas. Most of them were so far above her that she despaired of truly understanding them, especially what Wigan said about purposes. They were giving her credit for having come up with the solution to the problem of the Descolada virus, and yet she couldn't take credit because she hadn't meant to do it. She had thought she was just repeating Qin Zhao's questions. Could she take credit for something she did by accident? People should only be blamed or praised for what they meant to do. Wang Mu had always believed this instinctively. She didn't remember anyone telling it to her in so many words. The crimes that she was blaming Congress for were all deliberate. Genetically altering the people of Path to create the Godspoken, and sending the MD device to destroy the haven of the only other sentient species that they knew existed in the universe. But was that what they meant to do either? Maybe some of them, at least, thought that they were making the universe safe for humanity by destroying Lusitania. From what Wang Mu had heard about the Descolada, it could mean the end of all Earth-born life if it ever started spreading world to world among human beings. Maybe some of Congress, too, had decided to create the Godspoken of Path in order to benefit all of humanity, but then put the OCD in their brains
so that they couldn't get out of control and enslave all the inferior, normal humans. Maybe they all had good purposes in mind for the terrible things they did. Certainly Jin Zhao had a good purpose in mind, didn't she? So how could Wang Wu condemn her for her actions when she thought she was obeying the gods? Didn't everybody have some noble purpose in mind for their own actions? Wasn't everybody in their own eyes good? Except me, thought Wang Mu. In my own eyes, I'm foolish and weak. But they spoke of me as if I were better than I ever thought. Master Han praised me too. And those others spoke of Jin Zhao with pity and scorn. And I felt those feelings toward her too. Yet isn't Jin Zhao acting nobly and me basely? I betrayed my mistress. She has been loyal to her government and to her gods, which are real for her, though I no longer believe in them. How can I tell the good people from the bad, if the bad people all have some way of convincing themselves that they're trying to do good, even though they're doing something terrible? And the good people can believe that they're actually very bad, even though they're doing something good. Maybe you can only do good if you think you're bad. And if you think you're good, then you can only do bad. But that paradox was too much for her. There'd be no sense in the world if you had to judge people by the opposite of how they tried to seem. Wasn't it possible for a good person also to try to seem good? And just because somebody claimed to be scum didn't mean that he wasn't scum. Was there any way to judge people if you can't judge even by their purpose? Was there any way for Wang Mu to judge even herself? Half the time I don't even know the purpose of what I do. I came to this house because I was ambitious and wanted to be a secret maid to a rich, God-spoken girl. It was pure selfishness on my part and pure generosity that led Jin Zhao to take me in. And now here I am, helping Master Han commit treason. What is my purpose in that? I don't even know why I do what I do. How can I know what other people's true purposes are? There's no hope of ever knowing good from bad. She sat up in lotus position on her mat and pressed her face into her hands. It was as if she felt herself pressed against a wall. But it was a wall that she made herself. And if she could only find a way to move it aside, the way she could move her hands away from her face whenever she wanted, then she could easily push through to the truth. She moved her hands away. She opened her eyes. There was Master Han's terminal across the room. There, today, she has seen the faces of Eleonora Hibera von Hesse and Andrew Wigan and Jane's face. She remembered Wigan telling her what the gods would be like. Real gods will want to teach you how to be just like them. Why would he say such a thing? How could he know what a god would be? Somebody who wants to teach you how to know everything that they know and do everything that they do. What he was really describing was parents, not gods. Only there were plenty of parents who didn't do that. Plenty of parents who tried to keep their children down, to control them, to make slaves of them. Where she had grown up, Wang Mu had seen plenty of that. So what Wigan was describing wasn't parents, really. He was describing good parents. He wasn't telling her what the gods were. He was telling her what goodness was. To want other people to grow. To want other people to have all the good things that you have. And to spare them the bad things if you can. That was goodness. What were the gods then? They would want everyone else to know and have and be all good things. They would teach and share and train, but never force.
like my parents, thought Wang Mu. Clumsy and stupid sometimes, like all people, but they were good. They really did look out for me, even sometimes when they made me do hard things because they knew it would be good for me. Even sometimes when they were wrong, they were good. I can't judge them by their purpose after all. Everybody calls their purpose good, but my parents' purposes really were good, because they meant all their acts toward me to help me grow wiser and stronger and better. Even when they made me do hard things because they knew I had to learn from them. Even when they caused me pain. That was it. That's what the gods would be, if there were gods. They would want everyone else to have all that was good in life, just like good parents. But unlike parents or any other people, the gods would actually know what was good and have the power to cause good things to happen, even when nobody else understood that they were good. As Wigan said, real gods would be smarter and stronger than anybody else. They would have all the intelligence and power that it was possible to have. But a being like that, who was someone like Wang Mu to judge a god? She couldn't understand their purposes even if they told her. So how could she ever know that they were good? Yet the other approach, to trust in them and believe in them absolutely, wasn't that what Qin Zhao was doing? No. If there were gods, they would never act as Qin Zhao thought they acted, enslaving people, tormenting and humiliating them. Unless torment and humiliation were good for them. No! She almost cried aloud, and once again pressed her face into her hands, this time to keep silence. I can only judge by what I understand. If, as far as I can see, the gods that Qin Zhao believes in are only evil, then yes, perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps I can't comprehend the great purpose they accomplish by making the gods spoken into helpless slaves or destroying whole species. But in my heart, I have no choice but to reject such gods, because I can't see any good in what they're doing. Perhaps I'm so stupid and foolish that I will always be the enemy of the gods, working against their high and incomprehensible purposes. But I have to live my life according to what I understand. And what I understand is that there are no such gods as the ones the Godspoken teach us about. If they exist at all, they take pleasure in oppression and deception, humiliation and ignorance. They act to make other people smaller and themselves larger. Those would not be gods then, even if they existed. They would be enemies. Devils. The same with the beings, whoever they are, who made the Descola the virus. Yes, they would have to be very powerful to make a tool like that, but they would also have to be heartless, selfish, arrogant beings, to think that all life in the universe was theirs to manipulate as they saw fit. To send the Descolada out into the universe, not caring who it killed or what beautiful creatures it destroyed, those could not be gods either. Jane, now. Jane might be a god. Jane knew vast amounts of information and had great wisdom as well, and she was acting for the good of others, even when it would take her life, even now, after her life was forfeit. And Andrew Wigan, he might be a god. So wise and kind he seemed, and not acting for his own benefit, but for the Pequeninos. And Valentine, who called herself Demosthenes. She had worked to help other people find the truth and make wise decisions of their own. And Master Han, who was trying to do the right thing always, even when it cost him his daughter. Maybe even Ella, the scientist, even though she had not known all that she ought to have known, for she was not ashamed to learn truth from a servant girl. Of course, they were not the sort of gods who lived
off in the infinite west, in the palace of the royal mother. Nor were they gods in their own eyes. They would laugh at her for even thinking of it. But compared to her, they were gods indeed. They were so much wiser than Wang Mu, and so much more powerful. As far as she could understand their purposes, they were trying to help other people become as wise and powerful as possible. Even wiser and more powerful than they were themselves. So even though Wang Mu might be wrong, even though she might truly understand nothing at all about anything, nevertheless, she knew that her decision to work with these people was the right one for her to make. She could only do good as far as she understood what goodness was. And these people seemed to her to be doing good, while Congress seemed to be doing evil. So even though in the long run it might destroy her, for Master Han was now an enemy of Congress and might be arrested and killed, and her along with him, still, she would do it. She would never see real gods, but she could at least work to help those people who were as close to being gods as any real person could ever be. And if the gods don't like it, they can poison me in my sleep, or catch me on fire as I'm walking in the garden tomorrow, or just make my arms and legs and head drop off my body like crumbs off a cake. If they can't manage to stop a stupid little servant girl like me, they don't amount to much anyway.
15. Life and Death.
Ender's coming to see us.
He comes and talks to me all the time.
And we can talk directly into his mind, but he insists on coming. He doesn't feel like he's talking to us unless he sees us. He has a harder time distinguishing between his own thoughts and the ones we put in his mind when we converse from a distance. So he's coming.
And you don't like this?
He wants us to tell him answers, and we don't know any answers.
You know everything that the humans know. You got into space, didn't you? You don't even need their ansibles to talk from world to world.
They're so hungry for answers, these humans. They have so many questions.
We have questions too, you know.
They want to know why, or how. Everything all tied up into a nice, neat bundle, like a cocoon. The only time we do that is when we're metamorphosing a queen.
They like to understand everything. But so do we, you know.
Yes, you'd like to think you're just like the humans, wouldn't you? But you're not like Ender, not like the humans. He has to know the cause of everything. He has to make a story about everything, and we don't know any stories. We know memories. We know things that happen, but we don't know why they happen. Not the way he wants us to.
Of course you do.
We don't even care why, the way these humans do. We find out as much as we need to know to accomplish something, but they always want to know more than they need to know. After they get something to work, they're still hungry to know why it works and why the cause of its working works.
Aren't we like that?
Maybe you will be when the Descolada stops interfering with you.
Or maybe we'll be like your workers.
If you are, you won't care. They're all very happy. It's intelligence that makes you unhappy. The workers are either hungry or not hungry, in pain or not in pain. They're never curious or disappointed or anguished or ashamed. And when it comes to things like that, these humans make you and me look like workers.
I think you just don't know us well enough to compare.
We've been inside your head, and we've been inside Ender's head, and we've been inside our own heads for 1,000 generations. And these humans make us look like we're asleep. Even when they're asleep, they're not asleep. Earthborn animals do this thing inside their brains, a sort of mad firing off of synapses, controlled insanity. While they're asleep, the part of their brain that records sight or sound, it's firing off every hour or two while they sleep. Even when all the sights and sounds are complete random nonsense, their brains just keep on trying to assemble it into something sensible. They try to make stories out of it. It's complete random nonsense with no possible correlation to the real world, and yet they turn it into these crazy stories. And then they forget them. All that work coming up with these stories, and when they wake up, they forget almost all of them. But when they do remember, then they try to make stories about those crazy stories, trying to fit them into their real lives.
We know about their dreaming.
Maybe without the disc, Olada, you'll dream too.
Why should we want to? As you say, it's meaningless. Random firings of the synapses of the neurons in their brains.
They're practicing. They're doing it all the time. Coming up with stories, making connections, making sense out of nonsense.
What good is it when it means nothing?
That's just it. They have a hunger we know nothing about. The hunger for answers. The hunger for making sense. The hunger for stories.
We have stories.
You remember deeds. They make up deeds. They change what their stories mean. They transform things so that the same memory can mean 1,000 different things. Even from their dreams, sometimes they make up out of that randomness something that illuminates everything. Not one human being has anything like the kind of mind you have, the kind we have. Nothing as powerful. And their lives are so short. They die so fast. But in their century or so, they come up with 10,000 meanings for every one that we discover.
Most of them wrong.
Even if the vast majority of them are wrong, even if 99 of every 100 is stupid and wrong, out of 10,000 ideas, that still leaves them with 100 good ones. That's how they make up for being so stupid and having such short lives and small memories.
Dreams and madness.
Magic and mystery and philosophy.
You can't say that you never think of stories. What you've just been telling me is a story.
I know.
See? Humans do nothing you can't do.
Don't you understand? I got even this story from Ender's mind. It's his. and he got the seed of it from somebody else, something he read, and combined it with things he thought of until it made sense to him. It's all there in his head. While we are like you, we have a clear view of the world. I have no trouble finding my way through your mind, everything orderly and sensible and clear. You'd be as much at ease in mine. What's in your head is reality, more or less, as best you understand it. But in Ender's mind, madness. Thousands of competing, contradictory, impossible visions that make no sense at all because they can't all fit together, but they do fit together. He makes them fit together. This way today, that way tomorrow, as they're needed. As if he can make a new idea machine inside his head for every new problem he faces. As if he conceives of a new universe to live in. Every hour a new one. Often hopelessly wrong, and he ends up making mistakes and bad judgments. But sometimes so perfectly right that it opens things up like a miracle. And I look through his eyes and see the world his new way, and it changes everything. Madness, and then illumination. We knew everything there was to know before we met these humans, before we built our connection with Ender's mind. Now we discover that there are so many ways of knowing the same things that we'll never find them all.
Unless the humans teach you.
You see, we are scavengers also.
You're a scavenger. We're supplicants.
If only they were worthy of their own mental abilities.
Aren't they?
They are planning to blow you up, you remember. There's so much possibility in their minds, but they are still, after all, individually stupid and small-minded and half-blind and half-mad. There's still the 99% of their stories that are hideously wrong and lead them into terrible errors. Sometimes we wish we could tame them, like the workers. We tried to, you know, with Ender. But we couldn't do it. Couldn't make a worker of him.
Why not?
Too stupid. Can't pay attention long enough. Human minds lack focus. They get bored and wander off. We had to build a bridge outside him, using the computer that he was most closely bonded with. Computers now. Those things can pay attention, and their memory is neat, orderly, everything organized and findable.
But they don't dream.
No madness. Too bad.
Valentine showed up unbidden at Oliado's door. It was early morning. He wouldn't go to work till afternoon. He was a shift manager at the small brickworks. But he was already up and about, probably because his family was. The children were trooping out the door. I used to see this on television back in ancient days, thought Valentine. The family going out the door in the morning all at the same time, and Dad last of all with the briefcase. In their own way, my parents acted out that life. Never mind how deeply weird their children were. Never mind how after we paraded off to school in the morning, Peter and I went prowling through the nets, trying to take over the world through the use of pseudonyms.
Never mind that Ender was torn away from the family as a little boy and never saw any of them again, even on his one visit to Earth, except me. I think my parents still imagined they were doing it right, because they went through a ritual they had seen on TV. And here it is again, the children bursting through the door. That boy must be Nimbo, the one who was with Grego at the confrontation with the mob. But here he is, just a cliché child. No one would guess that he had been part of that terrible night only a little while ago. Mother gave them each a kiss. She was still a beautiful young woman, even with so many children. So ordinary, so like the cliché, and yet a remarkable woman, for she had married their father, hadn't she? She had seen past the deformity. And Dad, not yet off to work, so he could stand there watching them, patting them, kissing them, saying a few words. Light, clever, loving, the predictable father. So, what's wrong with this picture? The dad is Olhado. He has no eyes. Just the silvery metal orbs punctuated with two lens apertures in the one eye and the computer I.O. outlet in the other. The kids don't seem to notice. I'm still not used to it. Valentine, he said when he saw her. We need to talk, she said. He ushered her inside. He introduced his wife, Jacqueline. Skin so black it was almost blue. Laughing eyes, a beautiful wide smile that you wanted to dive into, it was so welcoming. She brought a limonada, ice cold and sweating in the morning heat, and then discreetly withdrew. You can stay, said Valentine. This isn't all that private. But she didn't want to stay. She had work to do, she said, and she was gone. I've wanted to meet you for a long time, said Olhado. I was meetable, she said. You were busy. I have no business, said Valentine. You have Andrew's business. We're meeting now, anyway. I've been curious about you, Olhado. Or do you prefer your given name, Lauro? In Milagre, your name is whatever people call you. I used to be Sule, for my middle name, Suleiman. Solomon the Wise. But after I lost my eyes, I was Olhado, then and forever. The Watched One? Olhado could mean that, yes, past participle of Olhar, but in this case it means the guy with the eyes. And that's your name? My wife calls me Lauro, he said, and my children call me father. And I? Whatever. Sule, then. Lauro, if you must. Sule makes me feel like I'm six.
And reminds you of the time when you could see. He laughed.
Oh, I can see now, thanks very much. I see very well.
So Andrew says, that's why I've come to you, to find out what you see.
Want me to play back a scene for you? A blast from the past? I have all my favorite memories stored on computer. I can plug in and play back anything you want. I have, for instance, Andrew's first visit in my family's home. I also have some top-flight family quarrels. Or do you prefer public events? Every mayor's inaugural since I got these eyes? People do consult me about things like that. What was worn, what was said. I often have trouble convincing them that my eyes record vision, not sound, just like their eyes. They think I should be a holographer and record it all for entertainment.
I don't want to see what you see. I want to know what you think.
Do you now?
Yes, I do.
I have no opinions. Not on anything you'd be interested in. I stay out of the family quarrels. I always have. And out of the family business. The only one of Novinia's children not to go into science. Science has brought everyone else so much happiness. It's hard to imagine why I wouldn't have gone into it.
Not hard to imagine, said Valentine.
And then because she had found that brittle-sounding people will talk quite openly if goaded, she added a little barb. I imagine that you simply didn't have the brains to keep up. Absolutely true, said Olhado. I only have wit enough to make bricks.
Really, said Valentine.
But you don't make bricks. On the contrary, I make hundreds of bricks a day. And with everyone knocking holes in their houses to build the new chapel, I foresee a booming business in the near future.
Lauro, said Valentine, you don't make bricks. The laborers in your factory make bricks.
And I, as manager, am not part of that?
Brickmakers make bricks. You make brickmakers.
I suppose. Mostly I make brickmakers tired.
You make other things, said Valentine.
Children.
Yes, said Olliado. And for the first time in the conversation, he relaxed. I do that. Of course, I have a partner. A gracious and beautiful woman. I looked for perfection and found something better. It wasn't just a line of patter. He meant it. And now the brittleness was gone. The wariness, too.
You have children. A husband.
A good family. Maybe almost as good as yours.
Ours lacks only the perfect mother, but the children will recover from that. To hear Andrew talk about you, you're the greatest human being who ever lived.
Well, Andrew is very sweet. He could also get away with saying such things because I wasn't here.
Well, now you are here, said Olliado. Why?
It happens that worlds and species of Raman are at a cusp of decision. And the way events have turned out, their future depends in large part on your family. I don't have time to discover things in a leisurely way. I don't have time to understand the family dynamics, why Gregor can pass from monster to hero in a single night, how Miro can be both suicidal and ambitious, why Quara is willing to let the Pequeninos die for the Descolada's sake. Ask Andrew. He understands them all. I never could. Andrew is in his own little hell right now. He feels responsible for everything. He's done his best, but King is dead. And the one thing your mother and Andrew both agree on is that somehow it's Andrew's fault. Your mother's leaving him has torn him up.
I know.
I don't even know how to console him. Or even which, as his loving sister, to hope for, that she'll come back into his life or leave him forever.
Olliado shrugged. All the brittleness was back.
Do you really not care? Asked Valentine. Or have you decided not to care?
Maybe I decided long ago, and now I really don't.
Part of being a good interviewer, too, is knowing when to be silent. Valentine waited.
But Olliado was also good at waiting. Valentine almost gave up and said something. She even toyed with the idea of confessing failure and leaving.
Then he spoke. When they replaced my eyes, they also took out the tear ducts. Natural tears would interfere with the industrial lubricants they put in my eyes.
Industrial?
My little joke, said Olliado.
I seem to be very dispassionate all the time, because my eyes never well up with tears, and people can't read my expressions.
It's funny, you know. The actual eyeball doesn't have any ability to change shape and show an expression. It just sits there.
Well, yes, your eyes dart around. They either keep steady eye contact or look down or up. But my eyes do that, too. They still move with perfect symmetry. They still point in the direction I'm looking. But people can't stand to look at them. So they look away. They don't read the expressions on my face. And therefore, they think there are no expressions. My eyes still sting and redden and swell a little at times when I would have cried if I still had tears.
In other words, said Valentine, you do care.
I always cared, he said.
Sometimes I thought I was the only one who understood, even though half the time I didn't know what it was that I was understanding. I withdrew and watched, and because I didn't have any personal ego on the line in the family quarrels, I could see more clearly than any of them. I saw the lines of power. Mother's absolute dominance, even though Marcan beat her when he was angry or drunk. Miro thinking it was Marcan he was rebelling against, when always it was Mother. Grego's meanness, his way of handling fear. Quara, absolutely contrary by nature, doing whatever she thought the people who mattered to her didn't want her to do. Ella, the noble martyr. What in the world would she be if she couldn't suffer? Holy, righteous king, finding God as his father,
on the premise that the best father is the invisible kind who never raises his voice.
You saw all this as a child? I'm good at seeing things. We passive, unbelonging observers always see better. Don't you think?
Valentine laughed.
Yes, we do. The same role, then, you think? You and I? Both historians?
Till your brother came. From the moment he walked in the door, it was obvious that he saw and understood everything just the way I saw it. It was exhilarating. Because, of course, I had never actually believed my own conclusions about my family. I never trusted my own judgments. Obviously, no one saw things the way I did, so I must be wrong. I even thought that I saw things so peculiarly because of my eyes, that if I had realized, I would have seen things Miro's way, or Mother's.
So Andrew confirmed your judgments.
More than that, he acted on them. He did something about them.
Oh? He was here as a speaker for the dead. But from the moment he walked in the door, he took...
over?
Took responsibility. For change. He saw all the sicknesses I saw, but he started healing them as best he could. I saw how he was with Grego, firm, but kind, with Quara, responding to what she really wanted instead of what she claimed to want, with King, respecting the distance he wanted to keep, with Miro, with Ella, with Mother, with everybody.
With you? Making me part of his life, connecting with me, watching me jack into my eye and still talking to me like a person. Do you know what that meant to me?
I can guess.
Not the part about me. I was a hungry little kid, I'll admit. The first kind person could have conned me, I'm sure. It's what he did about us all. It's how he treated us all differently and yet remained himself. You've got to think about the men in my life. Marcin, who we thought was our father, I had no idea who he was. All I ever saw was the liquor in him when he was drunk, and the thirst when he was sober. Thirst for alcohol, but also a thirst for respect that he could never get. And then he dropped over dead. Things got better at once, still not good, but better. I thought the best father is the one who isn't there. Only that wasn't true either, was it? Because my real father, Libo, the great scientist, the martyr, the hero of research, the love of my mother's life, he had sired all these delightful children on my mother. He could see the family in torment, and yet he did nothing.
Your mother didn't let him, Andrew said.
That's right. And one must always do things mother's way, mustn't one?
Novinia is a very imposing woman.
She thinks she's the only one in the world ever to suffer, said Oliado. I say that without rancor. I have simply observed that she is so full of pain, she's incapable of taking anyone else's pain seriously.
Try saying something rancorous next time. It might be more kind.
Oliado looked surprised.
Oh, you judging me?
Is this motherhood solidarity or something? Children who speak ill of their mothers must be slapped down.
But I assure you, Valentine, I meant it. No rancor, no grudges.
I know my mother, that's all. You said you wanted me to tell you what I saw. That's what I see.
That's what Andrew saw, too. All that pain. He's drawn to it. Pain sucks him like a magnet. And Mother had so much, she almost sucked him dry.
Except that maybe you can't suck Andrew dry. Maybe the well of compassion inside him is bottomless.
His passionate speech about Andrew surprised her, and pleased her too. You say King turned to God for the perfect invisible father. Who did you turn to? Not someone invisible, I think.
No. Not someone invisible.
Valentine studied his face in silence. I see everything in bas-relief, said Olhado. My depth perception is very poor. If we'd put a lens in each eye instead of both in one, the binocularity would be much improved. But I wanted to have the jack for the computer link. I wanted to be able to record the pictures, to be able to share them. So I see in bas-relief. As if everybody were a slightly rounded cardboard cutout, sliding across a flat painted background. In a way, it makes everybody seem so much closer together, sliding over each other like sheets of paper, rubbing on each other as they pass. She listened but said nothing for a while longer. Not someone invisible, he said, echoing, remembering. That's right. I saw what Andrew did in our family. I saw that he came in and listened and watched and understood who we were, each individual one of us. He tried to discover our need and then supply it. He took responsibility for other people, and it didn't seem to matter to him how much it cost him. And in the end, while he could never make the Hibera family normal, he gave us peace and pride and identity, stability. He married Mother and was kind to her. He loved us all. He was always there when we wanted him and seemed unhurt by it when we didn't. He was firm with us about expecting civilized behavior, but never indulged his whims at our expense. And I thought, this is so much more important than science, or politics either, or any particular profession or accomplishment or thing you can make. I thought, if I could just make a good family, if I could just learn to be to other children their whole lives what Andrew was coming so late into ours, then that would mean more in the long run. It would be a finer accomplishment than anything I could ever do with my mind or my hands. So you're a career father, said Valentine, who works at a brick factory to feed and clothe the family. Not a brickmaker who also has kids. Lini also feels the same way. Lini? Jacqueline, my wife. She followed her own road to the same place. We do what we must to earn our place in the community, but we live for the hours at home. For each other, for the children. It will never get me written up in the history books. You'd be surprised, said Valentine. It's a boring life to read about, said Olhado. Not to live, though. So, the secret that you protect from your tormented siblings is happiness. Peace, beauty, love, all the great abstractions. I may see them in bas-relief, but I see them up close. And you learned it from Andrew. Does he know?
I think so, said Olhado.
Do you want to know my most closely guarded secret? When we're alone together, just him and me, or me and Linny and him, when we're alone, I call him Papa, and he calls me Son. Valentine made no effort to stop her tears from flowing, as if they flowed half for him and half for her. So, Ender does have children after all, she said. I learned how to be a father from him, and I'm a damned good one. Valentine leaned forward. It was time to get down to business. That means that you, more than any of the others, stand to lose something truly beautiful and fine if we don't succeed in our endeavors. I know, said Olhado. My choice was a selfish one in the long run. I'm happy, but I can't do anything to help save Lusitania. Wrong, said Valentine. You just don't know yet. What can I do? Well, let's talk a while longer and see if we can find out. And if it's all right with you, Lauro, your Jacqueline should stop eavesdropping from the kitchen now and come on in and join us. Bashfully, Jacqueline came in and sat beside her husband. Valentine liked the way they held hands. After so many children, it reminded herself of holding hands with Jacht and how glad it made her feel. Lauro, she said, Andrew tells me that when you were younger, you were the brightest of all the Hibera children, that you spoke to him of wild philosophical speculations. Right now, Lauro, my adoptive nephew, it is wild philosophy we need. Has your brain been on hold since you were a child? Or do you still think thoughts of great profundity?
I have my thoughts, said Olliado, but I don't even believe them myself.
We're working on faster-than-light flight, Lauro. We're working on discovering the soul of a computer entity. We're trying to rebuild an artificial virus that has self-defense capabilities built into it. We're working on magic and miracles, so I'd be glad of any insights you can give me on the nature of life and reality. I don't even know what ideas Andrew was talking about, said Olliado. I quit studying physics. If I want studies, I'll read books. So let me tell you what we told a very bright Chinese servant girl on the world of Path. Let me know your thoughts, and I'll decide for myself what's useful and what isn't.
How? You're not a physicist either.
Valentine walked to the computer, waiting quietly in the corner. May I turn this on?
Pois no,
he said. Of course. Once it's on, Jane will be with us.
Oh.
Ender's personal program. The computer entity whose soul we're trying to locate.
Ah, he said. Maybe you should be telling me things.
I already know what I know. So start talking about those ideas you had as a child and what has become of them since.